It's time for Lynn Canal Voice, a public affairs talk show from the KHNS Local News. This month, we are talking to artists and authors of the Chilkat Valley. We'll be speaking with Haynes author Heather Lendy about her new book, Of Bears and Ballots, An Alaskan Adventure in Small Town Politics. We will also hear from master weaver Lonnie Hotch about her art, recent successes, and thoughts on art in the current moment. But first, we will speak with a group of artists and volunteers that helped create a series of road signs illustrating how to prevent the spread of COVID-19. KHNS's Claire Strempel kicks off the conversation.
So Haynes residents may have noticed some new signs in prominent places around the community illustrating how to prevent the spread of COVID-19. But they aren't typical health and safety posters. They're created by local artists. Margaret Friedenauer, Katie Craney, and Ari Marquardt were among a group of about 8 people involved in the project, and they're here to talk about it with us. So, Margaret, could you tell us a little bit about the origins of this project?
I'm not an artist. I helped execute it, but yeah, I'm definitely not one of the artists. So the origins are, I was working with the Haynesboro EOC as part of their public information outreach. I'm not doing that any longer, but at the time we were trying to disseminate information out into the community about the pandemic and how to take, you know, necessary precautions and stay healthy and everything that went along with providing that information. So a lot of our information we put out on Facebook, but in order to try to reach as many people as possible, we were also doing posters and box holders and newspaper and radio, PSAs, and as much as we could. But, you know, it was all generated by the EOC in a sort of a one-sided conversation. So we talked about ways to reach as many people as possible and what other methods we might not be using to share this as a conversation. So I saw, you know, across the state, there were other artists, like well-known artists like Ray Troll, and they were developing digital pieces and digital artwork that anybody was able to use on Facebook and across social media to kind of help get the healthy messages out. And but, you know, original public art can also do that. And I had seen some examples from Sitka and Ketchikan. I think some of them were just organic ideas from artists themselves. In Ketchikan, their EOC started using phrasing and posters that had to do with how staying 6 feet apart is equal to one fathom, you know. And so I think using language and examples that feel more relatable to our community, that seems to be really helpful, and it connects you to the message more. It's easy to kind of think of all the information that comes from the CDC and the science behind it, but you have to make it relatable to people, and art is relatable. So we just decided to ask some artists locally to bring their creativity to the conversation. We were kind of talking about how that can help inspire creativity in others. And, you know, public art kind of brings problem solving and imaginative results sometimes. And that's what we were looking to do with this project. So,
And what's the ultimate goal of these signs, or how would you measure if they were successful?
If people talked about them and noticed them. You know, at one point we put a mask on the killer whale at the public safety building. That was from the EOC too. As a visual way, I mean, what we're seeing with a lot of the things that, what we're seeing with the health precautions around the coronavirus is that these are very visual things that we have to do to keep ourselves healthy and keep our community healthy. Like wearing a mask is a very visual thing. Like staying 6 feet apart is a very visual, noticeable thing. It's not like when you get your vaccinations, nobody actually sees that or notices that, oh, there's a person who's vaccinated, there's a person who's not, or, you know, you can't always even tell when somebody has a cold. So, but the things we're being asked to do to keep ourselves and others healthy for this pandemic are very visual and is some of the struggle. And so art is very visual. Putting the mask on the killer whale was a very visual thing. We did that with the support of the Killer Whale House clan. And that was really important too, because that's a very cultural piece in Haines. And it represents a lot of the history and culture and present, just our present diversity of our community. And so putting a mask on it was a very visual thing to do. And it was very important to show that that was representative of our culture and our diversity in our community. And so them putting these giant signs up, and these are signs that had already been up, but they were black and white signs that had to do with the travel mandates and restrictions. These had to do with restrictions when they were first put up around the community. And then we wanted to convert them into messages, not restrictions. And so the messaging behind them was really to encourage a behavior like mask wearing and social distancing. And we thought art was a really creative way of doing that. So if people see them and if people talk about them, then I think they're successful.
Thanks. Well, so let's dive into the signs a little bit. Ari, would you like to tell us about your sign and kind of how you decided on your imagery and maybe how that tied into the placement of the sign?
Yeah. Well, I was contacted through Facebook. It's actually been a super useful platform lately with all the social distancing. And one of my friends was like, oh, hey, there's a sign. They're one of those COVID signs, they're actually painting over it and they're encouraging the public to, you know, maintain the healthy behavior to keep us from, you know, spreading COVID. And I was super interested right off the bat. At first she said that there was this one location. So I studied the area where the sign was and it's going to be, I suppose. And then she said, oh, it's actually down by the tank farm. And I was like, oh, I love that location. That's one of my favorite spots. So I went and took a picture and then just kind of visualized what goes along with all these colors, what would be eye-popping, and really thought about it for a couple of days. I had kind of a really short time frame to get it painted. It was about like 4 days. But I ended up taking a little bit longer. It's the biggest piece I've probably ever done. My favorite part of the painting is there's a young woman who's looking out and the sun's glaring in her eyes and she's looking at an elder off in the distance picking blueberries. And I was really trying to think, you know, it's not just about, you know, taking care of your friends. It's especially looking out for the elders, you know, and there's a lot of young groups in town who suppose, you know, oh, I'm young. I don't have to wear a mask. So I really wanted to like encourage, you know, we got to look out for each other. It's your health is everyone's health. And I really wanted to just encourage that because we all know each other here. We're all friends, such a small community that if anyone gets sick, it's heartbreaking. And so I was all in it. I was all for it. So I wanted to use really vibrant colors and, but not too, I wanted to make it kind of fun, you know, cause it's a scary topic and I didn't want to make it like, I wanted to get rid of the COVID material. It was like almost like military style, like stay in your home, you know, and I just wanted to make it like more friendly, more personal, like just like the old, the elder lady picking blueberries. That's like something that you would be doing here. And the woman wearing the mask has sock eyes on her mask, you know. And yeah.
Yeah. So Arlie, yeah, you kind of mentioned, you know, the signs that used to be very striking and not mm-hmm. particularly friendly. And you know, the subject, it's, yeah, it can be a little scary, you know, talking about the pandemic and making art about this moment. And I'm just, was that new to you, like kind of taking on a subject like this and making art about something that is kind of difficult to talk about? And you know, it's kind of a historic moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was definitely a first for me. And also having something so public was very new to me. So I was just thinking about the community as a whole. That's where, you know, at first I thought maybe I should go like a little bit more serious about it. But then I was like, no, I want everybody to feel like comfortable with safety. I want them to make it personal and normal, the new normal, basically. So, yeah, it was definitely a new project for me. I've never been in that kind of situation. And it was actually really neat, you know, because I could be proactive in my community in some way.
Neat.
Nice. And Katie, could you tell us a little about your sign, what it looks like, and, you know, how you made it?
Sure. Yeah, my sign, I guess to backtrack a little bit, I received a text message maybe the next day after this idea came to inception, and was just like, hey, we're going to do this thing. Do you want to do it? So the signs were all at the Chilkat Center, and you could go and pick up your sign. It was kind of a first come, first serve. The initial message was just asking artists who might be interested in painting a public sign. And so it was all a little bit cryptic, but it kind of made sense. And it was something that I absolutely felt was necessary to be a part of. And so I went to the Chilkat Center, then they had paint available, grabbed my sign, and I knew that the turnaround was really quick. They wanted the signs done as soon as possible so that this message could continue to be available to the public in a different way. And so, yeah, I grabbed the sign and came home and probably had it done in 2 or 3 days. So I didn't really think too in depth about it, which is interesting because usually that's the complete opposite of how I work. but I knew that the message was clear. I knew exactly where I wanted it to go. And so my sign is one of the 4x4 signs that's actually strapped underneath the killer whale at the intersection there. And I was surprised to know that that's where the sign was going to be. I had no idea. I just painted it, dropped it off, and that was it. So it on it is a mask with the Alaska, kind of a rendition of the Alaska, the Alaska flag. And I kept thinking about Alaska as a whole, like discussions were starting to happen about opening back up and what does that even mean? And just seeing things slowly start to spread in the state. It felt really important to just recognize that it really is, it takes everybody to be a part of this towards a solution. And so the wording on my sign is pretty simple. It's just, it takes a community. And the main reason behind that was just that it's a clear and simple message, that it's a simple gesture that you can do to protect others. You know, for the greater good, kind of like what Ari was saying, that it's the community as a whole, like how can you be a part of a solution and help your neighbors? So I thought that that was kind of the most simple way to approach it. It's a big image of a mask with the Alaska flag on it. And I wanted it to be vibrant too, just something that was eye-catching. So the colors are a little bit out of my comfort zone. Painting is a little bit out of my comfort zone. I don't normally paint. I used to paint, but I haven't painted anything of that size in a really long time, probably over 10 years since I've painted something that big. So that was a little bit out of my comfort zone too, but I think because the message was so clear and the idea was so important that I didn't really hesitate at all. It was just like, okay, this is what needs to be happening, and this is a way I can contribute along with following all the guidelines. And it's just something that hopefully could be seen as a simple gesture that you're wearing a mask to help someone else.
Nice. And I want to springboard off of something that you touched on, which is being out of your comfort zone. And I think for a lot of people, masking and social distancing are definitely out of their comfort zone. And I'm wondering how you guys have been reacting to those recommended precautions. Has it been difficult to follow those, to wear masks, to stay at home? How is it feeling for you, not just as an art practice, but physically in practice in your daily life?
I mean, I think everybody's feeling that. It is difficult just because it's so out of the ordinary that here we are in summer and we can't operate our businesses as normal. We can't even go to the grocery store as a regular experience. So I've definitely personally struggled with kind of doing the daily things in town. They're difficult, and it feels like it shouldn't be that hard. It should be like I feel like there should be a common understanding that and respect towards one another when you go to the post office or when you go to the grocery store, that like, yeah, we're doing this, I'm doing this for you and you're doing this for me. And so it's been hard to witness that here, that it's not a standard understanding of how we should be approaching this. So that part has probably been the most difficult. And then just the general uncertainty of all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And how about you, Ari? How have you been responding to the kind of the changes in what used to be normal everyday tasks?
Well, being an artist, honestly, it hasn't changed that much, I'll be honest. But I'm just being honest. But, you know, keeping a mask on, knowing how impactful it is and sticking to that is far more important than wanting to socialize. You know, if you truly care about the community and you truly care about people, then you're going to social distance. And it's very hard because I have so much family here. I have 5 brothers and my sister and then, you know, nieces and nephews. And as much as, you know, we all want to get together, we all want to socialize, my care for their health and for everybody is far greater than, you know, being able to see them and hug them as much as I want to. And just sticking to that, reminding, you know, myself that I have to maintain this in order for everyone to be healthy will really help me. I've been sticking to the rules and I know how important it is, and staying busy. You know, you have to make it the new norm. So adapting to this lifestyle is very hard for everybody, but if you can find ways to be creative and try and make it work, then that's where you will thrive. And I think this is a great time for people to really focus on what is truly meaningful in their lives and what makes them happy and keeps them healthy. And sticking to that, I think we can all make it as a community. I think we can get through this. And I'm staying hopeful and I'm keeping my mask on.
Yeah, Ari, at the start, you were kind of talking about how things are actually kind of normal for you as an artist. I'm wondering, with all this kind of free time, I guess, at least everybody's staying home, have you been making more art? And Katie, has it been kind of a productive time in some ways as an artist to, you know, get away from everybody and
well,
create?
The thing, what's hard is honestly, is like the mental, you know, you have to be in the right state, and there's so much distraction right now, like politically, you know, health-wise, with COVID, everything. It's so hard to get focused in that creative zone. So that's where it's kind of like ironic. I have all this free time, but then my mind's just like, I can't focus on anything. But I have been still trying to find, you know, those days where I can really get in the flow of things. But I don't really have much time to do that because I also have a toddler who doesn't have any daycare anymore. So just making it work, I guess, kind of like midnight oil, like where I can just work in the middle of the night. That's usually where I can actually make art. But yeah, so I guess there's a little bit extra time for being creative, but it's just trying to get in that right state.
I think similar to Ari, like it is hard to get into that space, but it is really important to tell the story of this time. And how are we going to do that? A lot of us are still processing because it's still very much here and it's not going away anytime soon. So just being kind of in the heart of this this time with everything going on has been really challenging to focus at all on making anything, because it seems like anything I make is completely irrelevant the next day, because I think a lot of my work tends to be more politically driven and has messages about what's happening in the world at large. And so it's been an interesting task, and I've had moments of complete shutdown, just can't make anything, and then other moments where it's like, oh, I maybe have some time to actually think things through that I've been thinking about for a long time. But it has definitely been a challenge, because so often I think people think that, because for instance, like with our business, that we might have all this time on our hands, but it's the complete opposite. I've never felt more busy in my life, just trying to keep up with the daily changes and mandates and just trying to make our business run. And then as an artist on the side, a lot of my shows and places that have my work on display, you know, they've closed down, galleries are shut. I've had some exhibitions that I've been planning on since 2018 have been pushed to 2022. So it's just like, well, I don't even know where I'm at with any of it, but I know that telling this story is important in whatever fashion that might be, and through any art form, I think it's really important right now.
Yeah.
And so this is for both of you or either of you, has creating public art with, you know, with a goal to communicate a really kind of distinct, actionable message, has that changed your personal practice of making?
I guess that's kind of what I do in general with my art practice, is reflecting the times. And since making the mask sign, I've been thinking about numbers and how dehumanizing the daily count has become. And so I've been thinking about a new piece that I've been making, which is kind of hard to talk about because I'm not quite ready to share it, but it has to do with how many people we've lost in Alaska and just keeping track of, like, I don't know anybody specifically in Alaska that has passed away from COVID, but it's something that I think we forget to grieve and mourn for the tremendous amount of loss. And then the inability for people to say goodbye to their loved ones has been something that I've been really grappling with, of how do you communicate that and how do you memorialize people who maybe didn't necessarily have to pass away from this. So that's something that I've been working on in a new piece, which is challenging. How do you talk about these things? And so hopefully art can help in some way.
Thanks for sharing that. Ari, do you have anything to add on that?
This in a sense, on the positive note, I think this provided me with the confidence to, you know, actually speak up about things. And that was actually really wonderful. And I have the same feeling where it's like, I wish I could, you know, create art that could help people more. And maybe this will give me the chance to actually want to head in that direction, because it's little things that count. And I've always kind of had this feeling like I didn't really have much direction with my art. Could go either plural opposites, like from illustrations to like graffiti to all different kinds of things. And maybe this is the direction that's possible where I could actually use it to help. And we'll see where that goes.
Margaret, how much longer do we get to enjoy these pieces of artwork? How long will they stay up in the community?
I'm not sure. That's up to the borough and the EOC. I hope they stay for a little while. I know the borough public works folks They worked really hard to find, I worked with them to find the appropriate places for them. And in some cases they had to build, you know, a way to have them structured and stand up. So I hope they stay for a while. I know Giselle, who painted one of the signs, went around and photographed them all so she could kind of document them. And I think she wants to have her sign back when she's done, if possible. And they could move around too, or we could create new ones. And I kind of hope in a way that maybe it'll spur more public art, even if the EOC doesn't officially ask for it. You know, at one point I was suggesting people paint over those old campaign signs we all put out in the yard in October. I did one for our garage sale. We painted over it, requesting people to wear masks when they, you know, walked into our yard sale. And we could all do that in our own yard. We could all create our own little pieces of art to support each other, because I think the more visual it is, the easier it is. And I just want to, you know, appreciate the artists, because I think the artists, especially since we have such a large artist community, kind of to what Ari said, I think if you can find and realize that artists can be social and civic leaders through their art, which is what I really went into this trying to encourage, advocating for those perspectives, sometimes challenging assumptions. I know public art sometimes challenges assumptions, but it can also bring us together around shared values, which is what I hope some of these pieces did, is recognize that we do have shared values around staying healthy as a community. So I hope they stay up for a little while, or they might move around and maybe create new art, because I know it can get easy to see something and then you forget about it. Oh, I'm used to seeing that there. So maybe if we change them up or move them around and get some new pieces at some point, that would be really awesome too. Kind of see it as an ongoing project.
Yeah, keep it fresh.
Keep it fresh. I do want to say, I'll tell you what surprised me about these pieces was when I started seeing them, how I loved, like, I think they all have this theme of empowerment. Like, if you see Giselle's, like, her Rosie the Riveter with, you know, because so many people are talking about food security and Victory Gardens now, like, she went off that theme. And Katie's was just so striking because it had the Alaska flag, which is why I asked for it to be put at the public safety building. It seemed to really fit there, like, mask, flag, like, that was the place for it. And Andrea's has the fish, and so naturally the harbor. And Amelia's has the family, which is, you know, I said we should put that at the pavilion because that's where the families hang out. And Ari's and Merrick's were kind of already known because of the size they were. They had the two big ones, but we wanted Ari's to, for people coming in off the ferry, we wanted a way to invite people into the community, and for people coming into the community to recognize that we have the shared value of staying healthy with social distancing and masking. And Merrick's has a really nice welcome, but also welcome to Haines, mask up, you know, like another way of expressing our shared community value around staying healthy for people coming in. And then Kelly's is at the airport, and Kelly's, I wish more people could see Kelly's, because Kelly's is Wonder Woman. And it's just, I love that all of these took very powerful images of people like our elders and our fishing community and Superwoman and Wonder Woman and Victory Gardens. And just like, that's what they used to communicate with, because I thought they all came in really not subdued. And I loved that about them.
So. That's awesome. Yeah, and it's interesting too. I know in the case of Katie, she was saying she wasn't sure where it was going to be, but it almost seems like each sign ended up getting kind of tailored to its audience based on its location and who's going to be seeing that sign in that area. That's kind of cool how that worked out. So.
Yeah, and I love that Katie's also has a toe strap around it. So, you know, it's very, very Haines. So.
I think that when I first saw it there, I was like, oh yes, it's on with a toe strap. It's perfect.
Well, it replaced the blue tart mask on the whale, which is also very Alaskan, so it was perfect.
We just heard from Haines residents Ari Marquardt, Katie Craney, and Margaret Friedenauer. They recently helped create a series of artistic road signs encouraging people to prevent the spread of COVID-19. You are listening to Lynn Canal Voice, a public affairs talk show brought to you by the KHNS Local News. My name is Henry Lishina, and I'm joined by Haines author Heather Lendy. You may have read her obituaries in the Chilkat Valley News or her books Find the Good, If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name, and Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. Her new book is called Of Bears and Ballots, An Alaskan Adventure in Small-Town Politics, and it's about her time serving on the Haynesboro Assembly, and we're going to be talking about it. So thanks for being here, Heather.
Thanks for having me, Henry.
You know, in all your books, a lot of them are about relationships, life experiences, and you know, kind of personal connections in this community and what makes Haynes. And in a way, a book about local politics is no exception. You know, it gets very personal, and there's a lot about relationships in here and working out differences and things like that. During your time on the assembly, did you try to separate the personal from the political, or is that just impossible? Like, where did you kind of see that distinction between your personal life and your political life?
Well, I mean, that was the continuous struggle, I suppose, you know, because of the relationships. And I even write about that. You know, I wish that declaring a conflict of interest could just be, hey, this is my friend, and I really don't want to be up here making this decision right now. Could somebody else do it? Where if I was, you know, going to make $100 on this decision, I could just say, oh, I can't do it, I have a conflict of interest. And I remember thinking, like, that's crazy. In Haynes, the pressure is much greater, at least for me, the pressure was always greater relationship wise than it was financial conflicts. That said, though, the other thing is that you have to really, as an assembly member, that was something that I got better at, I think, and learning how to make decisions that are in the best interest of the community. And that sometimes means that people you care about don't get what they want, and people you don't care about do. And that and as long as you do that, I think, in a way that is grounded in, you know, the code and the charter, and the arguments that were presented, and the legal stuff that the attorney says, and also what other assembly members do, and, you know, finally your own conscience, I think I felt more comfortable by the end. I got that part. Yeah. And I think that is what makes government work, when you can do it without animosity. The other thing too, is I think that people who really are, I learned this on the assembly, sort of who your friends really are in the community, and that people who really are understand when you make a decision that doesn't go their way.
Yeah.
And they're still your friend.
Yeah.
Likewise, you know, I had situations where people who were really angry with me over a decision I made, but I still care about them, and they're still my friend, and we got past that.
Yeah.
And I write about several of those situations in the book.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like, you know, in the book, it sounds like you struggled a lot with making those decisions and knowing there was always going to be somebody who's not happy with the decision. And at one point, you talk about how you've kind of always felt a need to please people and be accommodating, mm-hmm. to a point that it's actually a negative quality. It's, you know, it's not helpful to be that accommodating. And so I'm wondering, you know, what did you learn about decision making in itself, like on behalf of a community? You know, were you trying to, you know, make the decision that the most amount of people wanted, or was it, you know, trying to analyze the information you have before you and make, you know, an educated decision just about the information? Like, you know, what factors were going into decision making, and what did you learn about, you know, that process and how you try to come to those decisions?
This might explain the most of what helped me to make decisions. Obviously, the information that's provided, the staff. I trusted, the manager, Deborah Schnabel, and the clerk, Aleka. I deferred. A lot of what happens at the government level comes from the people who do the work. and you have to listen to what they say, or the tourism director when it's a tour permit. But you also have to listen to people in the community and your own heart. The one thing that helped me the most when I was in all this sort of kind of push me, pull me, what do I do, you know, and how do I make things work properly, was something that Deborah Schnabel sat me down and told me at one point when she saw that I was being torn up by one issue or another. And she said, Heather, use your mother brain. And I said, what? She said, I watch you in the room, right? Your writer brain and your community brain is so full of empathy that you generally like even all these people, even the ones who are like kind of behaving the worst that you disagree with. There's a relationship there that I enjoy. I enjoy the characters, the people. I've known them for years. I can appreciate that, you know, as just an observer and a caring community member, and I want to please them. And she said, look, you've raised 5 kids, you know, and they're good kids and they've grown up to be productive adults. And so they couldn't have always had everything they wanted all the time. And then I remember I said to her, you know, yeah, I mean, I had to say no to my kids when they were teenagers and I loved them. And there's people in this room that I don't even like that much. I guess you're right. I could be a little, you know, and once I started thinking that way, that really, really helped me. She said, don't use your writer brain. Don't use your, you know, grandma, I want to make everybody happy here brain. Use your mother brain. And then I felt if I made decisions out of the love of the community, the same way I make them out of love for my children, and I know what's right and wrong, and sometimes even my family didn't agree with me, but in the long run, it worked out. That's how I went forward after that. And that really helped me. Once Deborah was hired and she gave me that advice, it was the best advice I got.
At the start of the book, you said that in part you were kind of inspired to run, you know, based on national conversations about politics and, mm-hmm. and you know, the divisions we see across the United States. And I'm wondering if you feel like national divisions are reflected in Haynes, or if Haynes is kind of a different environment, you know, what do you think the interplay is between national politics and local politics?
I think it's getting more and more. And I used to think, well, you know, Haynes was divided and that now the national was copying us. But I think with the rise in the different sources of news in social media, and that played a huge part in the time I was on the assembly, you know, the different social media pages that you're not part of and the things that are circulated and you don't know, or the fact that even people who are on the other side, just it's no comment. They proudly say, we don't listen to the radio and we don't read the newspaper and we get our information from our friends, wherever they are, but not from you. And that creates a really difficult situation because we're not all dealing with the same consensus of what even the issue is. We can't even agree on that because there's different things happening over in this room and over in that room. And when they meet, it's like, no, that's not true. And it's like, well, no, that is. And that happened a lot on the assembly. And I think we're seeing it now clearly in the response to COVID-19 with the, you know, people in Haynes care about each other. I mean, I know we do, and we always have. And everybody always says, you know, when bad things happen, we stick together. And I know that's true from my own experience. And I know that's true of this town. So why the fight about the masks? Like, I don't understand how even the health situation in the community has become politicized. And that can only be nationally, because that's just not a normal Haynes local response. And it doesn't really fall on all those lines, I don't think. I mean, I hope not. Mm-hmm. But it's scary when it happens here, because it's not really who we are, I don't mm-hmm. think.
But do you see exceptions to the traditional division between left and right, you know, liberal and conservative,
of course you do.
Pro-development,
I mean,
greeny,
time.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, you do all the time, and mm-hmm. you can't, and I think that you can't pin people here on one thing or another. I mean, right. If somebody goes to church, or if somebody's a hunter, or if somebody has a small business, or if somebody's an attorney, none of these things necessarily reflect a political position. It's just the things that we do. And so I think, and to me, that leads great hope.
You know, during the book, you talk about how for a period of time on the assembly, maybe the entire time, who knows, but people would approach you with concerns that they weren't represented by the assembly. They felt that the members of the assembly didn't represent them and their community and the people they knew. And, you know, sometimes they would reference the way Haynes used to be, what it was like when I grew up, you know. And at one point in the book, Don Turner Jr. approaches you, and he's mentioning this issue, saying the right people aren't voting in elections. He asks if you'd be willing to work on a get out the vote campaign, which you say, yeah, I would support something like that. Now I've heard kind of the same complaints about the assembly from more liberal people, saying that there's a conservative majority on the assembly that doesn't represent us. So I'm wondering, do you think there is a way to provide better representation on the assembly, or at least make people feel like they're better represented by the assembly, or is it just kind of a matter of perception?
I don't know. I mean, if I could answer that, then I mean, I'd be clean or something.
You'd solve politics.
I don't know why, Henry. I mean, I look at other towns and people seem to be able to get along. I think part of it is generational. If we could just get people who aren't either part of old fights, left, right, coming in or onto the assembly, or people who aren't, you know, still sort of related to people who were parts of old fights, you know, coming in, that if we took your generation, if we took a newer group and start again, I think that might go a long way. But yeah, as always,
so these are kind of entrenched positions
that I think they are, and I think it swings years back and forth, and it's a lot of the same characters, myself included, that get involved in these things that haven't changed much over 30 years. Yeah. And I think that if we can get a generational change, that would be good. I think I've heard that people say, well, you know, it takes too much time and there's too much work on the assembly. Well, then change that. I mean, it's your government. Say, we don't want this many meetings, or they don't have to be. Yes, it's in code, you know, and that's always, code is law and we have to follow, but you can change the code. You can change it. You can change the way that we do government, and to make it easier then for people who are younger. And it used to be, I mean, I hate to say, when we talk about the good old days, but when my husband was on the city council, you know, we had a whole little pack of young children. He was just starting a business, you know, and they met once a month, and they met at 7 o'clock, and the meeting was over by 9, because everybody on there had young children and jobs and they had to get home again. And he could go after dinner, you know, and now the meetings have them to start at 5 and they don't get out until 11, and they're almost every night of the week sometimes. And yeah, that's too much. They never had committee meetings at 1 in the afternoon or 10 in the morning then, because people couldn't have gone. And it could be argued that the town ran a little better because everybody was a little busier. and it worked. So I think that when people say they can't run because of the time commitment, they can change that.
To kind of switch gears here, I was hoping we could talk about success. but you do talk about in the book kind of how you define success in government. You know, usually things move slowly. And again, you know, no matter what the decision, someone's going to be unhappy with it. But at one point in the book, and actually one of the chapter's titles kind of references a quote from Tom Morfitt, where he describes the democratic process as glorious chaos. And that's after some meetings that took an incredibly long time, multiple day meetings, to make a decision about transporting rocks through a neighborhood. And this is kind of seen as a success in the book, at least the way you present it. So I'm wondering, kind of, you know, what does success look like in local government? What were those moments where you felt like, you know, we've actually done something here?
Well, I think that one particularly was successful because the assembly all worked together despite some differences and despite especially all the initial pressure. We had just come off the whole, you know, the harbor issues, the people were already yelling about a recall. We were all off balance, and yet we had this other completely different issue that we had to focus on, and we sort of stopped the bleeding, it seemed like, and everybody regrouped, you know, from everybody, and we listened, and we, you know, came up with, I think, a solution, and that just felt good. I think it felt good that nobody was calling anybody any names, that that we were trying to solve a problem, and I think that's solving a problem maybe is easier than making policies and ordinances and stuff. And on the assembly, sometimes other things get in the way of solving the problems, ideologies. People get in their head that certain things are happening and they're not, and it kind of derails the whole thing. So, I mean, there's a lot of successes that are never even reported. I mean, just the roads are plowed, and when you turn the water on, it's clean, and, you know, toilets flush. There's a million things that are government that are successful, and we tend to miss those, but those are all the little decisions that are made by the assembly all the time that nobody even comments on. Those ordinances, you don't even say boo.
One thing that I noticed in your book, and you use this kind of device in some of your other books, where you break up the chapters. So in If You Lived Here, I Know Your Name, you would break up chapters with snippets from the social column duly noted in the Chilkat Valley News. Mm-hmm. So just these little happenings around town. But then in Of Bears and Ballots, instead of using duly noted, it's the manager and committee reports about these kind of, and for the most part, they're little successes about, well, you know, today we took the floats out of the harbor. It looked like there was one float that needed repairs, but we should be able to handle it. And I found that those were kind of the little successes you're talking about, you know.
And I love them. And I put those in on purpose. And they're actual committee and manager reports from the, I don't know, the three different managers that we had at my time between the interim and the first one. And they were taken from each of them. And I just did them in to show especially the counterpoint to some of the chaos that was happening at assembly meetings, or what people were thinking that, you know, what are these people doing? And they're all crazy and incompetent, or I shouldn't say crazy. I mean, you know, they're not capable of doing these things. And then you read, you know, we're getting a new snowplow. There was an event at the Chilkat Center. The summer reading program is on, you know, there's a, like you say, the floats went in, the floats come out. And through the course of the 3 years, government functions and the town functions. And I think I put them in there as well to remind people what government does, because so many people, it's quite popular to not like government. Government's all bad. And actually, you know, the temperature at the pool is government, and the books in the library are government, and the snowplow is, and, you know, the ambulance crew is, and things that people depend on and that wouldn't want it any other way.
Well, you've been listening to Lynn Canal Voice. We've been speaking with Heather Lendy, a local author here in Haines. Her new book is called Of Bears and Ballots, An Alaskan Adventure in Small Town Politics. Heather, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Henry.
You're listening to Lynn Canal Voice on KHNS. Now we are going to hear an interview that KHNS's Claire Strempel recorded with master weaver Lonnie Hotch about her artwork and career.
So tell me, since we last spoke, how has your art practice been, and has the COVID-19 pandemic influenced the way you work?
Well, I have shifted gears a lot and haven't been doing a lot of artwork. You know, towards the end of winter, I was finishing up projects, and I was working towards, I was supposed to go to this event in, I think it's in Michigan, that Arts Academy, Cranbrook Cranbrook Arts Academy for the SA Artists Fellowship convening. And I was supposed to present. So I was getting ready for that. And I made a woven scarf, because my regalia is too much to carry that distance. And it's my regalia. The weaving that I normally wear is really not my own anymore, because I presented it to the clan. So I didn't feel comfortable carrying that across country and, you know, check baggage or carry on. So I decided to make a scarf that is kind of a mini of my robe. So I finished that, and I was supposed to go to Yakutat to collect spruce roots over there, because they have real sandy soil over there, because they're close proximity glaciers, and they have the best roots. So I was going to go over there with my cousin Jenny, and we were going to harvest spruce roots, but the COVID-19 put the kibosh on that. So my life hasn't changed a whole lot because of the COVID thing, but yeah, I have things to look forward to, though.
You were telling me a little bit about the stories that are in your weaving, and I'm wondering if you have any projects on the horizon, any stories that you want to tell.
Well, I'm thinking right now in my head. I've got a project coming up. You know, I told you I did that scarf. I could pull that out and show it to you too, but I'm thinking I want to do a Chilkat piece that would be just a scarf, because those are more portable. You know, if I do have to travel for an event, I can help showcase my culture, my people in a tangible way. You know, having that art without having to carry a whole, you know, lug around a big suitcase. You know, it'll be something smaller than my suit, you know, my clothing suitcase, instead of having two suitcases, one with just regalia and the other with my clothes. I can condense it all into one. Yeah. I don't like traveling a lot of stuff.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because it sounds like the art is such an opportunity to communicate a complex identity, and a really particular one. So tell me a little bit about what would go into that scarf, or how the scarf would tell the story.
Well, Clockwan is really well known for the Chilkat blankets that were made here. And I know there's an effort to change the name Chilkat, but I think that name is going to stay. And it's our people that really carried that practice forward. You know, we have a long line of weavers in my family. And so I feel really connected to that weaving tradition. It's real big part of who I am, and it's a real big part of Klukwan's history. So when I wear something with Chilkat weaving, it's representative of who I am and where I'm from, for that reason. In the same way that, you know, we send athletes to the Olympics and wear the American flag, you know, on their athletic gear. And they carry the American flag. So it's a way to show your colors, you know, and be proud of who I am and where I came from, and represent, you know, our people. When we're growing up, our elders would tell us, you know, you're not just representing yourself, you're representing your family, your house group, your clan, your community, and the Tlingit people as a whole. And so we watch how we behave to represent our people well. I'm just not my own person. I'm part of the Klukwan community.
And could you tell me, you used the example of the stars and stripes, or those are the symbols on the American flag. What are the symbols on your Chilkat scarf?
Well, I haven't made it yet, but it will be, you know, the typical Northwest Coast, you know, Chilkat weaving style with the totem figures, you know, ovoids and U forms and, you know, bird or animal shapes, those types of things. Yeah, I'm still contemplating the design, so, but it'll have traditional colors, you know, the black and yellow and white and turquoise type blue, Chilkat blue. Those are real traditional colors. Here's my scarf. Here, let me just put it on for you. See, it's not very wide.
Describe it a little bit. It looks like it has a beautiful black and white pattern. Is that the salmon bone, the fish bone?
Yeah, the backbone of the salmon. And then this is the crater, raven's tail cross pattern. And it has this little piece of abalone representing the treasure of the Chilkat, which is the salmon, the five species of salmon. So it's beautiful. An abbreviated version of my robe.
And so what did you weave it out of?
It's just the merino sheep wool. I backed the little, this is woven separately and attached, this little piece at the end, these little pieces at the end.
Yeah, those look like crosses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what's that symbol?
That's the, alludes to the creator. And it's also called raven's tail in the weaving tradition. So these are in the center field of my Chilkat River robe. So I wanted to include those. But this doesn't have all the, like it doesn't have the Hooligan depth net pattern, and it doesn't have the river pattern. It just has the top border and the center field designs on it. So it's an abbreviated version.
The Cliff's Notes of the weaving. Yeah. And tell me, there's also a trim on it as well. What is that?
That's, this is sea otter. And this is just the fringe, but it makes a nice, kind of dresses up the edges of the weaving.
Oh, that's great.
When I get to do that presentation, I will wear this to represent who I am and where I came from.
That's beautiful. And so tell me, do you have any upcoming community art events or any teaching events? I know that the pandemic has somewhat disrupted regular programming, but.
Yeah, we were planning to do a spruce root harvest here in Haines and Clukwan this spring, but the pandemic put the kibosh on that because our instructor couldn't come. Oh, I just feel so restricted. But all my creative energy has been going into my garden lately. So I've really expanded and the community garden, I've been involved in that and applied for a grant and we got it from the Rural Cap to put in a greenhouse. And so I'm going to apply for another one with the Sustained Southeast, what is it, food security one, to kind of like fully equip that greenhouse, you know, build some raised beds and get some plant pots and irrigation system and all that.
So it sounds like maybe some pandemic necessity has rerouted your creative flow.
Yeah, you know, want our people to survive this.
That's all for this month's Lynn Canal Voice. Thanks so much for joining us. You are listening to KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Clukwan.